The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hey, listeners, this episode of the Battlestar Galactic cast may feature spoilers for events that come later on in the series. So be warned.
Be warned.
All ministers and officials should now go to Case Orange. Repeat, this is an official colonial government broadcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Battlestar Galactic cast brought to you by Sci-Fi Wire. My name is Mark Bernardin.
Hello, Mark.
Hey, Trisha.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing all right.
It is late on some hot night in Southern California. The sky is ablaze with maybe distant wildfires and...
Mm-hmm. I've had no injections into my back and been under anesthesia like the last couple of podcasts.
You're feeling awesome.
I am feeling awesome, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the world is either on fire or soaking wet because I think there are hurricanes smashing the East Coast. But we are here today to talk about Someone to Watch Over Me.
Written by Bradley Thompson and David Weddle and directed by Michael Nankin.
Indeed, and we have a special guest to talk about Someone to Watch Over Me with. A person who years ago we approached about coming on the podcast who said, you know what? I want to do Someone to Watch Over Me. And we were like, but dude, that's like 98 years from now. And he said, we'll all be here. Where are we going to go? I mean, we'll find some time. I mean, we're all scattered to the winds in our offices and sets. But, you know, we'll find time to be at the same place at the same time. It didn't quite work out that way.
We're on a virtual same place at the same time.
Yes, because, you know, as much as we would love to be out in the world doing worldly things, we are not. Instead, we are here in our cozy Zoom cavern to talk to Mr. Bear McCreary. Bear McCreary!
Hey, you guys.
Is that our own theme of Bear McCreary?
Yeah, I should write a special one for this episode. It's more of a fanfare, you know, just for my entrance, you know?
Yeah, lots of horns.
Yeah.
We dug out the corn gold just for you.
Yeah.
Now, before we get into this, previously on Battlestar Galacticast, just to reiterate where we are in this world, we were in deadlock.
We were.
Which quite a bit happened. The fifth and final Cylon was reunited with the other four. Boomer helps her escape. And
Ellen Tylon. Ellen Tylon wreaked havoc on Galactica. You know, she stuck a wedge between Ty and Caprica 6.
Causing the miscarriage of the first ever Cylon. Baby.
Indeed. You know, and also previously on, we go all the way back to like, remember when like Kara died and then didn't die, but then found evidence of her own death on Earth, but is haunted by it? And huh? Big standard giant Kara questions as we have. But yeah, like before we get into it proper, how you doing, Bear?
I'm doing great. I'm looking forward to this.
What can you recall when conversations about Someone to Watch Over Me began to happen? Because I mean, tell us also what your process was on the show on any given episode. Like, when did you get into the conversation, and how was this different?
Oh, this is extremely different. I've never done an episode of television like this. I've never done anything like this. typically, I would work on an episode by going into post-production and seeing a rough cut. That would be the first time I experience any of it. And then I would have a week or two. In some cases, I would end up with a month or two if if there was a, you know, the schedule allowed. But basically, I would go home, write the music as fast as I could, record it, get it to the mix stage, and go in and look at the next episode. This one was extremely different. I got a call from David Weddle and Bradley Thompson that they wanted to consult with me on the script for this episode, hinting that there was some musicality to it. Not only musicality, but that they wanted to know what it was like writing music because they had a character that was going to be struggling with their music. And it was either the first or the second phone call. I remember them calling me, and I was in a extremely vulnerable and dark place. I was in the middle of writing the end of 410, Revelations, When They Find Earth. Oof. And I've got this big piece with choir, a piece that ended up being called Diaspora Oratorio. And I worked on that piece of music for a week. I mean, I've never felt like a piece of music almost killed me before. So I'm in the middle of it, and I'm just like, I'm in this place of despair and self-loathing, and I just can't muster anything that has the grandeur of what you want this moment to have. Especially knowing that it's like, it's almost all a misdirect. Like, you need all this emotion, and then at the end of the episode, it's like a dagger through the heart. I mean, it's like, I'm dying here. And I'm running out of time. So David calls me and they go, hey, can we talk with you about writing music? And I was like, I was really nervous. And I at this point, I knew those guys pretty well. But I was still nervous. Like, they're my bosses. I don't know how open I can be with them. But I said, guys, I don't want to lie to you. Like, I'm really struggling right now. Like, I'm in this, like, really dark place. I'm trying to write this cue for your episode. I'm just dying here. I just don't feel like talking. And then David goes, that's great.
I was going to say, they use it in this, right?
I went, what? And he goes, no, hold on. Wait, I'm going to write this down. Tell me everything. And I was like, I'm miserable. I've been at this for days. I hate myself. And he's like, uh-huh. This is awesome. This is wonderful. I hear, like, you know, and then Bradley's like, uh-huh, go on. Tell me more. There are things that I said. A lot of things I said ended up directly in the script. And I'll keep an ear out when we get to the episode. At least one or two things that I said about my creative process, this character ended up saying on camera in the show. He is saying what I was saying trying to score episode 410. So
I might have written a couple of them down. Yeah. So it'll be funny.
Yeah. I know. How long? So it's like, yeah.
How long on average does it take you to score an episode of television?
I mean, I always say that I spend the amount of time I'm given. On a network show, you can have 7 days. Mm. An episode of Battlestar, I usually had averaged, I want to say, 10 to 14 days. But it got as crunchy as less than a week. And there were some episodes that I had, like, you know, like 6 months on, depending on the schedule. This one, you know, was obviously really different. There was music that needed to be written in advance. Then there was music that I ultimately, after doing, I worked on this episode off and on for like a year, and then I still had to score it. I mean, I still got to the end and had to do all the work that I did on all the other episodes. So yeah, I mean, I started off just consulting David and Bradley and working with them on their script. Then I flew up there and worked with Michael Nankin, the director, and was on set. I was working with the actors. I was working with Rourke Cricklow. I was working with Katie. And writing stuff in my hotel room at night. I, like, didn't sleep at all. Writing stuff to play on set to try to get some visual performances of. It was an unusual experience, to say the least.
Now, the pianist playing, you said Robert, right?
Rourke.
Yeah. Did he actually play?
He's a real musician, and Nankin wanted a really natural performance. He wanted to get takes where He was actually noodling around and playing. And so I was working with him to give him some concepts to improvise around that would sort of pay off and be part of this Gnomian's third, this hypothetical piece of classical music within the world that, you know, we'll get into all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I replaced all those performances because I wanted to really control in a fine-tuned way what the notes are, you know, and what those performances were. But he really is playing. I mean, and you see his hands, and when he's playing and talking, he is playing and talking. And in some cases, I'm matching his performance, and in other places, I'm replacing painstakingly, note by note, the piano that was recorded on set with a virtual instrument that I made of that piano. I mean, I say I didn't sleep. One of the nights, me and the sound recordist stayed up, God, 7 hours. I sat at that piece of you-know-what piano sampling every note like 5 or 6 times to be able to digitally recreate that exact piano. Oh, on wow. The set of Battlestar Galactica. So, like, the acoustics, everything, it was a perfect recreation of what that sounded like. That was the level of detail and madness that we would go to on this. You know, like, that's insane. You could use any sampled piano library and it'd be fine. But no, I want that piano. It's the Battlestar piano.
All right, I'm going to press play, and we're going to get into We Are Watching for the First Time. I'm sure our sci-fi masters will be happy about this. On The Peacock.
Oh, I thought you were going to do Le Peacock, like we always do.
Le Peacock.
I was ready to say Le Peacock.
The oh, Peacock. Yes, bienvenue, Le Peacock.
Peacock. It was. I'm glad you said he was a real musician, because it's, as an actor, it's so hard, especially you haven't been given the time to familiarize yourself with an instrument, because just the naturalness that you have if you actually are playing and he's talking to her while he's playing, as opposed to this stilted, like, oh, I'm talking, I don't know what my fingers are doing, I don't know, you know, it's just the fact that
Nankin and I used to joke so much about movies where the actor isn't a pianist and you don't see their hands and they're moving all over the place, they're swaying back and forth, and you're like, that's not right, you know, like, if you're playing, you have to physically, like, be where you are. And yeah, so just that physicality, that comfort, was incredible. It was totally authentic. And props go to Nankin for being really clear. I mean, that made his job harder, but it made the end result better.
Awesome. It plays right. Such a, you know, it's a character in it. So it, yeah.
All right, we're pressing play. We're at 000, and if you're watching along, now's when you go. Yay, Battlestar Galactica!
The fractures.
Her bones are rotten. I don't know. I don't know why that's my Eddie. And I feel like Eddie and Ty for me are both kind of the same thing. Just one is a little bit more like, imagine the one eye being crazy wide, and that becomes Ty. The bones are rotten. It's like Ahab.
Yes. Getting down to the wire here.
These previous Leons became so iconic, you know? Like, they were so exciting when you would watch new episodes on the air, you know? Because it would give you a hint of where we're going. Ah, here we go.
Right into the piano keys. I've always wanted to work on a show where we created a previously on of entirely new footage, so it wasn't previously on. It's like, yeah, huh? No, all of this is a lie.
So here's this really elegant montage that we created that shows Kara's kind of, I don't even want to say mundane, it's less pleasant than that, but her existence and this, hinted at this piano performance. And one of the things that's interesting is you notice, like, there's that velvet cover over the keys that he removes. It tells you that this thing is precious, this completely beat up piano. Because we were talking about, like, what kind of piano would have survived the apocalypse? Like, there wouldn't be that many of them. And the keys are dented, it's out of tune, but, like, he still covers it with the dust cover. I loved that touch, you know, as an opening image.
Is that something that you added on, or is that something that would have been in the right in the script, or a Nankin thing?
I don't remember. I feel like it was a Nankin thing, but I could be wrong. I don't remember. It's just an either way. It's just a fascinating way that the visual storytelling, as it pertains to music, tells you something subliminal that is cool. It's not necessary for the story, but it does add a layer of dimension, you know?
Yeah, it's a little bit like that. There's a line in The Magnificent Seven where they're talking about when they're hired to first do that job. And yeah. It's like, well, how much are they paying you?
I love this line. One of my favorite lines.
Yeah, they're paying you. Well, it's everything they have. Like, well, I've never been paid everything before.
He goes, I've been paid a lot, but I've never been paid everything. Yeah. Oh, so powerful.
And it's like, yeah, this is my piece of shit piano, but it's my piece of shit piano.
Yeah.
I appreciated this opening montage because it's a reflection of where she is in her life, you know, and it's all of this has happened before. All of this will happen again. And this is another day, week, month in the life of Kara Thrace, and everything is uninspired.
That's David and Bradley back there, by the way. Left.
Oh, it is.
Yeah. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but that's a short shot.
No, by all means.
So here we see the piano keys again. I wrote this piece called Elegy, which is for this sequence where I matched his finger movements, and this sort of all is revealed later to be part of this composition that he would always play for her. Right now it just plays almost like score. And this is definitely one of those episodes where we merged the ideas of score and source music together.
And there's, you know, a lot of Battlestar is haunting in its own way, you know, and this episode, it brings it, you know, it's also sitting in the back a little bit like a theme, which is Galactica's on her last legs. Like, this ship is no longer structurally sound. You know, there's a line that Tyrell says, like, yeah, she's got a few more jumps, but not many. And there are scenes when people are just talking and there's like dust in the air because like you can just hear the ship kind of struggling, like wheezing, panting, struggling to breathe.
I mean, in a weird way, the piano is kind of a visual metaphor for that, isn't it? I mean, it barely works, but it's it's doing what we need it to do right now, you know?
Yeah. And hey, look, that model is Sonya.
I know. I made that note. I was like, I was right last episode. It is Sonya. So we had an episode in Deadlock last episode. I was like, wait, I thought it was Caprica to begin with. And then it's Sonya. And I was like, oh, no, it's Sonya. So I was very happy when she was actually called out by name in this one.
I know. Yes. So every like three episodes, Trish is like, that's Natalie. I'm like, who? Nobody said her name.
I'm like, it was in the scripts. That's Natalie.
Yeah, come on, Mark. It's obvious. Duh. Jeez.
So this one was Sonya, yes. And she, right before we cut to the, whatever it's called.
Titles.
Credits, yeah. thank you, Mark. You know the thing where my name comes up? we find out that Sonya has been elected to serve on the Quorum.
Yeah, the Quorum of Ship's Captains, they're calling it now.
Yes, right. So she is she's on the Quorum for the base ship. Mm-hmm. And she wants Boomer to be released. And at first, you know, that Rosalind and Adama are against that. But then she goes, oh, no, I didn't word that properly. We want to try that. That eight was the one that went against the rest of the Cylons. You sided with Cavill. And we want to try her for treason. Yeah. So that will follow through throughout the episode. But
and Tyrell is none too pleased about that. Because, like, they're going to kill her because he knows they're going to find her guilty. And she even says, well, we didn't even have capital punishment when there was resurrection. But now there's no resurrection. Yeah. We got a new arrow in the quiver.
Yeah, now there's a significance for that. So,
yeah. Is a role like this as rare as I think it is, Trisha, to be able to have so many layers of nuance and so many versions of a character? I just got to think that this was a totally unusual experience for you.
Yeah, well, sort of like we talked to you a little bit before or after, depending on where it airs in our schedule. But about you, this being, you know, Battlestar being your first job essentially out of school, and 33 being really your first composing of a TV show. Battlestar was my first series. I was, 5 or 6 years older than you. Seven, something like that. But it was my first series as an actor. So it was so new that you just kind of roll with it and you could just go with your gut. And, you know, maybe there would have been some changes that I would have done looking back a little bit. But I'm also glad I didn't overanalyze it too much and just sort of went with my gut on it. But it was
wonderful.
Rare, yes, looking. Although I didn't know going into the series, right? I didn't know that I was going to have as many characters as I ended up having.
Of course, yeah. I didn't know I would be writing music that like transcends the score and becomes, you know, part of the narrative structure of the story. I mean, sometimes if you think about if someone had told us in the beginning all the stuff we would get to do by the end, your head would explode, you know? So this line when he says, I've been at it for 4 days, and she's like, then quit. I was 4 days into scoring Revelations when they called me. That's why that ended up in the script. That was me complaining.
And she says, okay, so I wrote this down. And he says, you know, it's hard. And she goes, well, what's the point? And he says, the point is to bring a little grace and beauty to an otherwise ugly and brutal existence.
Yeah.
I found that beautiful.
Yeah, if anything, that's almost like the theme, not musical, the narrative theme of the episode. I mean, it's such a, it kind of distills, I think, music as a metaphor for the story in this episode. All these close-ups of the hand are worth commenting on, that like, he's really playing. I revoiced some of his notes and replaced stuff so that I could blend it into the score where needed. But that's the real deal. That's why Michael could shoot that any way he needed to have this hands in the frame and not. There was, you know, a shot where Rourke is playing and he's talking. And of course it looks casual, but to any, especially I'm sure actors that are used to looking for this, you don't always see that. The hands playing while the actor's talking. Like it's
no. You see
a certain
actor,
amount of work went into that.
And then you see an insert of hands playing.
Yes.
And then you see the actor.
And believe me, as a composer, anytime I'm watching a visual medium, that's the first thing I look for. I'm like, huh, I wonder if they're going to show the hands and the face in the same frame. Oh, they're not? Huh, okay.
Fancy that.
Or, you know what I mean? Or if it's like somebody's playing guitar, no matter what they're saying, I'm watching their left hand being like, are they doing anything real? You know?
Or like, and, same and with it, stunts, right? Like when you see, when you never see the actor's face, it's pretty obvious they're not doing many of the stunts themselves.
Yeah. But likewise, when they throw in one shot that shows they really are, your respect level then goes like, boom, way up.
Yeah. You know?
I did
we haven't
like
even
this.
Talked about the other arc in this episode. That
Yeah, the Boomer Tyrell arc. I mean, and you sort of get their version of previously on. We're just like, remember all the things that happened to us? We were totally young and in love. And then you shot the old man and then you got shot by Callie. And, you know, that line of, you know, how many of us ended up with the ones we really want?
Yeah. You blink and you miss it. We just saw my musical notes that Hera's drawing here. We'll come back to them later. But she keeps drawing these circles.
Did you tell, like, so you wrote out at what she has to follow. Did they have, like, little X, like, mark things for her to follow?
I sent them the sheet music notation for the theme that I used in All Along the Watchtower. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. The 12 notes that would ultimately become the 12 notes that become the coordinates. And I just took the note heads off and I was like, look at this kind of caterpillar looking thing with these 12 dots. Space them this way so you get the sense of the rhythm. Draelide Thrace, there's her dad's.
Where did that music name come from?
I'm not sure. That would be a David and Bradley thing. It was always that way. There are the notes. There they are. There are my notes.
Yeah. Which, like, don't, like, I appreciate the attempt at a misdirect, but it's like, come on, guys. Like, that's totally music. Right, like I know what you're trying to. Look at stars. No, it's not stars.
Yeah.
But I mean,
and there's a whole note at the end too. Like the rhythms are right. Like you could just you could bar it out exactly.
Now we know that, but an audience watching it for the first time, would they have pieced that together at this point? Or we just know that Starbuck has had drawings. You know, she drew this the nebula or whatever. You know, like all that is. We're thinking more it's art as opposed to music at that point.
I don't think anyone would ever think it's music, honestly. And then even if they did, to put together what it is, and it's this thing that we've heard so many times, and that ties in with Kara's past. I mean, there's a lot of threads that come together here.
Yeah.
You know, it's worth noting since you guys are going to get there soon in the finale when this comes back. And I had a funny conversation with Ron about that where he goes, hey, so remember those notes we did? Is there a way to turn those notes into coordinates? Can I spoil the finale? Is it too? Whatever. Spoiler alert. But
yeah, you can
whatever.
Say spoiler alert. Whatever. Plug your ears if you haven't listened. Yeah.
He said, is there a way to turn those into coordinates for, let's say, someplace? There you go. And so I go, well, yeah. I mean, actually, we could do all these sorts of calculations, converting rhythms into the, like, you know, if we had a couple of, like, lines of dialogue or, like, a scene even to talk about it. And Ron goes, no. No, like, you'd have no dialogue. It needs to happen visually, and it needs to happen in, like, 10 seconds. And I was like, what? And then he tells me the action that is happening at the same time. It is urgent, to say the least. And I was like, give me a beat. But I circled back with Kevin Grazier, the science advisor. We talked about the number of digits that you need for coordinates, which happened to be 12, which happened to be the number of colonies, which happened to be the number of notes in the tune that I wrote for All Along the Watchtower. I mean, we all planned that out.
Are you serious?
Dude, it's crazy, right? It's like fits the coordinates perfectly, perfectly. And then I was like, well, God, I mean, maybe. And I talked with the editors and I was like, can you just show her playing the piano with her fingers and then put numbers on the screen? And then I talked with Kevin and I go, if you convert my notes into a scale, just the bottom note is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. None of them go past 12. Can you use those as the digits that show up on screen? And the science worked out. He's like, yeah, that would totally be the coordinates that would work out. And I was like, so then that's it. Like the notes that we get in this episode are easily translated using a scale with numbers as into a code. And I think that like it works explaining it visually in the finale. I sound like a crazy person talking about it now. This shouldn't work, right? It's like
one of you is a Cylon. I don't know who.
Yeah. Oh, I love this narrative device, this projection house.
Yeah.
This is amazing.
It's one of those where at the end of the episode, do we think she was doing it on purpose? I don't know. I haven't watched the next episode to see, but.
It doesn't matter because you feel, look at the face he's giving, that Aaron is bringing his A game here.
Yeah.
It's the emotion is so real. Also, random trivia.
Sorry?
Oh, I was just going to say random trivia with these two. In season one, I thought this was going to be like the big love arc episode 6 or whatever. I forget. But anyway, early in the season, they have this scene where they get together and I've got this love theme that I wrote for them. And then they break up and I'm like, oh man, they'll be back together again. That love theme's going to be all over this show. And then of course they aren't until now. So
you're like, the love theme comes back.
I know. I went
no
to my,
work.
I was like, I went back to the masters and I was like, I had a theme for these guys, didn't I? Sure enough, I did. And there it is.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Here we are talking about the music again.
Yes. I named this piano player Billy Joel. Because I don't know what his real name is, but I was like, sing me a song, you're the piano man. And I went to a bar, bottle of red, bottle of white. His name is Billy Joel.
There you are.
Yes.
So I think in the script he was called Slick. But we don't ever get any name for this character, do we?
No. Hence Billy Joel.
There you go.
Might as well be Billy Joel.
Oh, those sketches that he just... close. We get a close-up of him later. That's all me. It's all my music, like, handwritten out on the staff paper, musical staff paper with the corners cut out. It was awesome. I loved it. I was like, I should write the score to the show on this.
I was going to say, is it the score? Is it pertained to the actual music in this show, or is it just...
It is. No, it is, because I was writing music the entire time I was on set. I was writing for him. I was writing... for reference to use later. I was exploring ideas, and I just wrote them all out. And you can actually kind of see it. There's an insert shot somewhere in here where you can pick it up, and it's the real deal. So that
do you still have those pages?
Awesome. I think they got auctioned off. Mm. Honestly, I think they got auctioned off. However, when we get to the dream sequence with baby Kara, I have that piano. It's right there. I write on it every day. So I didn't get to keep the sheet music, but I ended up with the piano. I gave a shout out to Todd Sharp earlier in our other podcast, but Todd gave me the piano. He got it through the auction, and his kids played it for a long time. And then when he moved or something, he gave it to me. So it's like, I love you, Todd. Thank you for the Battlestar piano being in my studio. Thanks to you.
Oh, that's great. Oh,
that's nice that it came around. Yeah.
I ended up, for some reason, I can barely remember, I interviewed Damon Lindelof for an article I was writing for Hollywood Reporter, and I went to his office, and on his wall, he had a framed piece of sheet music from John Williams, The Imperial March.
Nice.
Signed by John. And I was like, dude, that's the coolest thing in this office, and the hatch from Lost is right there.
And you're right.
He's like, you're right.
Wow, man, that's incredible. That's incredible. Yeah, John Williams' signature is so beautiful because he writes everything by hand. I can't even handwrite anymore. I'm like, blah. My signature is awful. But his is like, it's like calligraphy. I mean, it's just like, it's inspiring.
It's gorgeous. I like you, Trisha, was a little bit like, is Boomer playing him? I don't want to think so. I feel like this is all genuine. I think she's still in love with him, and he's totally in love with her. And I was very satisfied with my belief, which didn't pan out, I don't think.
Yeah.
I know. I really it took everything that I had not to go straight to the next episode. But I was taken in because I wasn't judging her at this point. I was really drawn into the story of him seeing projection for the first time and them talking about this and then the child and everything. Yeah.
Like he's in a deodorant commercial now. He like opens the door. He's like, oh, feel it.
Fresh and breathy, spring fresh.
Irish spring. But yeah, and I think there was a line later where she does say, like, everything that I said, I was legit and true and valid. But I did some things that you're not going to like me for.
I'm not going to tell you in advance.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And I like the just the little revelations of like the deepness of her hallucination or illusion of their life. Like, yeah, there's a kid. And this has been going on so long that this kid is now old. You know, this kid is 9 or 10.
No. Yeah, very powerful.
Yeah. It's a little hand.
It's very difficult watching this now as a father when I was not when I wrote this. My daughter is approaching this age, you know? I mean, my daughter's 6 now. But, it's... It's hitting me hard now, you know, and it hit me hard then, but it's just a very personal and kind of profound feeling, you know?
Like there's a very real sense that this was the life that he always wanted for himself. This is what he thought he was going to do.
There's your music.
Yeah, there it is.
You know? And suddenly, like, Kara and Billy Joel are, like, crazy chummy. Like, she's got her foot up on the bench and this, you know, little glass of brown hooch drinking. Like,
Well, he called her on her sarcasm and she comes around. Yep. You know, that's how you get through to the Starbucks of the world, right? You call them all on their phone. You call them on. She was telling him to shut up the night before, so.
Yeah. And also,
this is a big moment where she's talking about Nomian's third sonata, second movement. She's kind of calling him on quoting it, and
he's like, Nomian.
Nomian.
Yeah. Nomian. Yeah. Nomian. You should see my notes about trying to, because I wasn't watching it with subtitles, trying to figure out how to write that. It's like, no means there's a second movement. What?
Now, another random trivia. I'm fairly certain it's this scene, but I'm not sure because I'm not hearing it right now. But the quotation she's talking about, and again, it's in here somewhere, but what I call like Nomayan's third or whatever, there's a quote that is actually Stu Phillips' music from Battlestar Galactica.
What?
The OG. Yes.
Really?
And I it's not the main fanfare. It's this beautiful secondary theme that Stu wrote. This like really moody and beautiful. And I was joking, but I was like, I want Stu Phillips to be part of this. Like this, because this piece they're talking about, this classical music that she's playing, is not the sort of watchtower, profound Kara music. It's a separate thing. It's how she's bonding with him. So we really needed another piece of music, and that's where the Stu Phillips idea came in. So this is a scene with the piano that I'm looking at in my studio right now. This is this flashback scene, which is on supposed to be her childhood piano. It's not the one that's in the in the bar.
Yeah,
the one she would play with her father would play on.
Yeah. Yeah. So we actually had two pianos on set, and this was the nicer one.
I will say these scare tactics that's about to happen right about now when she touches her young self on the shoulder. Yeah, oh, that gets me every time.
Yeah.
That's fracked up.
We saw it at the beginning when she opens up her locker in the opening montage, right? Mm. We see the flash of it. So we know that it's, you know, she hasn't told anyone, I don't think.
No, Billy Joel is the only other person.
This is a huge deal that she's revealing this to him. And it's all about their, you know, their bond, their connection.
Yeah. She's talked about her mom before. I mean, she hadn't told us the fact that she knows she's died. Leoba knows, but she hasn't told anybody else yet on Galactica, I don't think. Unless I'm remembering wrong. But she's talked about her mother before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like never her father.
I had a note in my notes later on when we talk about, when we get deeper into her sort of trauma with her father, is that this episode is very much the counterpart to Maelstrom, which where we hear about Socrata Thrace, and they're both written by Bradley and David, and they're both directed by Michael Nankin. And it seems like this is just the other half of a sort of diptych where they wanted to explore the vast tragedies that have shaped Kara Thrace.
Yeah.
And it's it once it like, and I didn't realize that until I got like halfway through, and it got crazy powerful for me. Just that like those two guys had a story they wanted to tell about the ways that Kara Thrace was forged in fire, and that fire was very often either physical spousal abuse or mental spousal, I mean parental abuse. And in this case, abandonment.
And we had such stories from Bradley and David. Remember when we were shooting, when we were doing Maelstrom? Bradley and David guested on Maelstrom with us.
Nice.
And they had the personal stories that they brought into writing that script as well.
Like it was very dealing, real for them.
Yeah, very real for them, and dealing with parental figures and abuse. It was,
Yeah. Well, and this was their last script for the show. It was Michael Nankin's last episode for the show. I mean, this is what they wanted to say. And I think it shows, you know, that there's this powerful story that they wanted to tell. They wanted to finish.
This is heartbreaking watching Aaron. He's so good.
Yeah.
And he just, you know, he's pleading with them not to sign the extradition
And
contract,
Rosalind,
whatever. Yeah. And
Rosalind
like,
tells him, like, personal feelings are what Sharon Valeri preys upon. You know that better than any of us.
And is she right, you guys?
Because, like, once the order is signed and, like, the chief is like, well, there's nothing I can do. I got to do something. I gotta be the guy who solves a problem like Maria. And what does he do? Like, he spots, like, hey, there's an eight that just looks like my eight because they all look like my eight. Whang!
And yeah,
upside the head with a giant wrench.
Testing out the ability. Well, wasn't he there testing out the ability to make the ship go offline for a bit?
Well, it had been sort of flickering on and off.
Yes.
And so he just turns off like the main bus switch and all the power goes out. And he puts his plan into motion.
Yep. Puts it into motion.
Yes. Meanwhile, Billy Joel is still working these ivories. And he seems to have been married once.
Weird sexual tension between the two of them that they like had to sort of acknowledge, like, where is this going? And then it doesn't go there.
Right. And I appreciated it not going there because there was like three or four.
Oh, for sure. But it also makes it more real that they acknowledge that, you know, like Kara puts the feeler out there, and then it's like because she's still trying to get a read on who this guy is. Here it is. My gods, you're just like my father. There it is.
You're just like my father.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can consider what you did to your kid. Like,
this is great. And then the lights come back on. It's so good. So great.
Yeah.
I love it. It's not here, but it's in their earlier scene when she was talking about the song that her dad was teaching her, and she said, it made me feel sad and happy and sad all at the same time. And he goes,
yeah,
the best ones always do. The best ones do. And I was like, oh.
Yeah. And I mean, that's like my goal with my music in life. Like that's what I want out of it, you know, to give those two emotions. And this show gave so many opportunities for that.
Do you know, I just totally messed up, Mark, when you were saying the wrench. It just didn't dawn on me at all because I remember seeing Boomer when they're saying Boomer's still asleep. I'm like, oh, they were beating her up in there. Which girl was beating her up? I'm so fracking dumb sometimes. I seriously thought watching this that he tried it again another time and he got like it was a test run. No, Trisha.
No, it's the one run.
It's the one run.
It's okay.
Oh, I wonder how I put my socks on the right feet.
We got the Rona brain. I think that's all
fine. We got the Rona brain. I'm like, wow, I flashed back to like when, you know, they were beating up the prisoners. Anyway, now I'm on board. I'm on board.
So here's what's crazy. This scene here I recreated with Katie on stage at the House of Blues with me at the piano and her sitting next to me in front of a live audience with my band when I performed the music of Battlestar Galactica. And this went into All Along the Watchtower. I brought her out at the Encore and sat her next to me and kind of recreated this scene, teaching her the line note by note, which is funny because here she's giving this incredible performance. And at the House of Blues, she'd just actually forgotten the tune. But either way, it was like very hesitant. And it was like, bum, 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 boop. Like, it was great. I mean, it was so genuine. And, but I'll never forget that like.
That's awesome.
Getting to recreate this really powerful scene.
Yeah, it's a beautiful scene. And like you said, the performance is fantastic as well.
Yeah.
In it.
She's so shaken by it. It's awesome.
Yeah, this scene. Oh,
Boomer's just boomering all over the place, and she rolls up in Athena, beats the shit out of her. Then she changes into Athena's gear, and here comes Hilo, who, like, dude,
he's like, "You're going away for 6 days. Let's get it on."
But also, how, like, it's you got to know these things, Hilo, how to tell your wife apart from, you know, another person who looks just like your wife. Like, there's no excuse for that. It's like, "Oh, I'm sorry, I had sex with your twin sister." You can't do that.
It's like, and you smell different. No, you smell good.
Yeah.
But
yeah, man, you just can't.
He's got that gash on his head, you guys. Maybe he's not thinking clearly, you know?
True, it wasn't too long ago that they got, you know, a little beat up. So he's maybe not quite all there. Just like, I had a brain fart moment just a few minutes ago, so.
It's all practically the same thing, Trisha. It's
totally.
Like,
it is heart-wrenching, though, to see Athena in the, yeah. And this is heart-wrenching, too. Ty saying that he didn't want to see.
Ian Cottle was right. I never should have insisted on seeing him. His eyes were open. I wasn't ready for that. Little
like he
guy
was looking at me.
Right at me.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is what I was saying when Athena is aware of what's going on and she starts to come to. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
As her husband is fucking her twin sister. Also, how is nobody else coming into this bathroom? This is like a public bathroom, right? Like,
it is a unisex head. Yes.
Yes. It's, I don't, traffic is low in this part of Galactica, I guess. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. There's not a lot of foot traffic through
the Galactica never sleeps.
Heavy breathing and moaning. The best part about watching this with the closed captions is seeing how they describe things like this. Earlier it was chuckling and crying when the chief was in his first projection. Now it's heavy breathing and groaning.
And all my hard work is reduced to piano music.
Just like a little asterisk.
Yeah, with a little music notes. It's like, oh. Yeah.
Moaning intensifies.
Yeah, there it is.
That would, I think, be one of the hardest things, though, right? If you can't hear and you're reading the subtitles, you can't portray the music. You can read, understand
difficult.
What's going on, but you can't, because music obviously plays
so here's
such
this great,
an integral role.
This is this awesome bit where he starts playing the supporting idea, and I'm always curious chatting with fans, you know, like, when did you start piecing it together, what they're playing, you know? Now we're connecting the dots with the notes that Mark thinks is so obvious. I disagree.
Well,
whatever, man.
I don't think you could have known what the notes would be.
Oh,
but
he's
backpedaling
now. Like half an hour ago, you're like, whatever, man. I totally called it. Yeah,
but
I totally called it, dude.
But I think the idea that they're notes is kind of, I'm not going to say obvious, but isn't like the best hidden secret in the world.
Well, and especially when you open the episode with like, who is this piano player? Like right out of the gate, it's like, you know.
Right.
It's arguable that like this guy came out of nowhere literally because he's never been seen before.
Right. And spoilers will never be seen again.
Indeed. So here we go. Here's this duet that works so beautifully. And
as Boomer comes really, and steals a kid.
Yeah, start shaping the drama of the music with what's happening.
Now, I mean, maybe we'll talk about it when we get... Well, I'll save it. We only got a couple minutes left to save it for. While we watch this heinous crime of kidnapping take place. Oh, and drugging of a child. Because that little sippy cup is not just water.
Okay, hold on. This shot right here. Everyone is listening to me play the piano on that take. I was sitting at the piano playing exactly what you're hearing. And as the camera's pushing in on them, they and you'll see when they get up, like the take just kept going. I drew the Cylons to me, like right over to the piano. I was in tears. It was so amazing. I was like, this is the greatest thing I've ever done in my life. Mm-hmm. Watching the, he's like, Bear's playing so well right now, you know, like, and everybody just gets up and it was, and now here the music starts to really take off.
Playing the fracking song.
There it is, right? But it's like he was actually hearing that. He's hearing it in real life as he's giving that performance.
I love when you can actually hear, as opposed to like, okay, we're playing it over the audio once and then you're just imagining it, when you actually can hear it.
Yeah.
And especially something so like integral as this and everything, like it's all coming full circle. And
yeah.
Yeah. And when they all notice it, it's bone chilling.
It was incredible to be able to kind of be part of that in real time, you know, on the set. Oh, I'm getting choked up. This is so good.
Yeah. So now, is this person supposed to be her father? That's, for me, that's kind of what the story is telling me.
Well, I interpret it that he is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And is her father supposed to have been the boxed seven Daniels who were... incredibly creative and fond for the art and artistic. Yes.
That I don't know. And I'm not even sure or is her father the same sort of somewhat unexplained apparition that she is, you know?
Mm-hmm. I like to think that it is. We'll have to grill Ron for the finale. So, but hey, by the way, before we go too deep into this, let's talk about Billy Joel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really? The piano man? Yes, the piano man.
Piano man. Is that Daniel?
Yeah. FYI, just asking.
Just asking, yeah.
Yeah.
I think there might be onto something there.
Yeah. And this poor fucking Tyrrell. What a mook.
But
this is heartbreaking.
He fell for the wrong girl again. And this scene where she just comes in like just beaten up and Hilo's like, look, I got work. What?
Oh, yeah. Brutal.
I love this, and it might not be my frack down, but when she is, you know, she gets out the information so that he can relay it. But this moment here where they, you know, Hila realizes what happens and she's hugging him and, you know, all she wants to do is hug him. But at the same time, she just wants him away from her. Like, and she's hitting him and it's just so.
Yeah. How did you know that was not me? You moron.
But then at the same time,
it's
with
so real,
it's so real. And then obviously, you know, with obviously Haragon, it's like, but you also just want him as close as you can get him. But it was a moment. Yeah.
Very much so. And trying to play out the charade of, sorry, there's just traffic on the outgoing patterns. We'll clear you in a second. It's like, nope, she knows.
And then he gets on, Adama gets on, hey, Boomer. he like, all right, she knows. Let's just go straight there then.
Yeah.
And Roslyn here, everything, it's just...
it all just unravels.
And she's good. Yeah. She's spooling up the FTL. Like, if she jumps, the whole ship's not going to be able to withstand that.
Yeah, because as we've been told throughout the last couple of episodes, she ain't doing too good, the Galactica. And the spatial distortion from a jump might just buckle the entire hull.
Yeah.
You know, I do.
This is actually one of my favorite cues in the movie, in the episode, where it actually doesn't have anything to do with the piano player or any of that stuff. It's just developing this really cool, hypnotic, tense, just horrific emotional idea repeating over and over, getting louder and louder. And it was sort of one of the last unexpected surprises. I mean, after I'd worked on all this piano music, when we got into post, I got to do this scene, you know?
Yeah, which is just like sub-thriller stuff.
Oh, my God. And a lot of the subs, I guess, pun not intended, I brought in, every once in a while I bring in the rhythm section from Oingo Boingo. This is the John Avila on bass, Steve Bartek on guitar, because I wanted that like really cool hypnotic bass line for this sequence. They're one of my secret weapons. Oh, God, wow. Look at that.
That's so beautiful. I mean, and it never ceases to amaze me how impressive the CG is on this show, which is now 15 years old, and it's as state-of-the-art as anything else.
And all while this is going, you know, everything that's going on here and the calm, not the calmness of Rosalind, but the pain of Rosalind, but also her sickness and the quiet of her amongst pain, mind you, but and
it makes
her
it
collapsing.
More devastating.
Her collapsing.
Because this is also like her cancer getting the better of her, right? I mean, this is, it's like her body can't sustain itself anymore.
Yeah, she's been deteriorating. And so it's like all of that coming together with the explosion. And we can't hear the music right now, obviously, because we're talking over top of it. But
she is very much like Galactica. Like one more hit and she can't take it anymore. And because,
oh God, and speaking of just devastating hits.
How it
here
lands.
We go. Here we go.
The look on his face.
Yeah, just the...
Like, I did it. I carried her on board.
Yeah, and it's the betrayal as well, right? Not just about that I had a part to play with the child's disappearance, but the betrayal as well.
She did exactly what Rosalind said she was going to do. She played me for a fool.
Yeah. And here they are talking about that song that they've heard.
Yeah. And this other
plugged
bit.
Plugged into something, yeah.
That Cavill has been orchestrating this from the very beginning. That Cavill, you know, my escape, all of it. I was just a means to get Boomer here. Cavill wanted Hera. Boomer got her for him. And it was like, oh, well, Ellen would make it all about her. But still, oh.
Yeah. And here we're hearing her dad's composition, which we hear a snippet of here. It's really, I'm just so proud of this piece. I actually expanded it, and the version that's on the record is much longer. I just wanted to live in this musical world. I wanted to write the entire piece more than you hear in the show. Oh, Jesus, this scene is so powerful.
I'm always impressed by... I was on a show called Carnival Row, which was all sprung from the mind of one dude. And I remember asking him once, he's like, yeah, well, this character's a poet. By the way, I've written a book of her poetry. And I was like, dude, you don't have to do that. Nobody's going to see that. It's like, well, yeah, I just needed to do it just to have done it. And so I completely understand the impulse to like, no, I got to write this whole piece of music. Like, of course I do. Duh.
Right, a snippet.
Yeah,
the little bit wasn't enough. I needed more.
I gotta go the whole way here.
Yeah, totally. What a powerful episode. It was just something that changed me forever. You know, was working on that.
Like you said, this was the first time that you worked with the music incorporated, like beforehand, not just looking at the you know, the edit and composing it, but then working with the writers, working with your, yeah. some of your words in the dialogue, some of, you know.
Yeah, I felt like just a little part of my soul got imprinted on this episode, you know, and I don't know that I'll ever have an experience like that again, you know, like many on Galactica, but.
Well, you certainly have had a lot of experiences since.
That is true. But nothing like this. Nothing where the music exists on all these different levels. And it's so personal. It's not just like, oh, yeah, I can tell you about music. But it's my creative struggles that ended up sort of influencing how they wrote this character. Like, random trivia. They made me audition for that character, okay? It was the most awkward and embarrassing thing ever. But I did. I went in and auditioned because they were like, you should come in. And I was like, it was horrible. I hope those tapes have been destroyed. But like to that shows you the degree to which Michael and David and Bradley were like, this guy is like you. Like, you know, he is the embodiment of what you are telling us about your creative experience.
I would now like somebody to dig up. Can Sharn maybe find the audition
team?
Yes! I should ask her. Sharn has never. So much.
Never.
She probably wouldn't have that, but.
It's got to be somewhere.
Oh my God. I hate to say you're right. It's got to be somewhere. I'm picturing like the vault at the end of Raiders, you know, like stacks and stacks of boxes and somewhere in there, the worst audition ever. But yeah, I mean, it was really great to be invited in to collaborate that closely and to really just feel like, you know, feel like part of the family. And yeah, I'll never forget it.
That's awesome. Yeah, I love, you know, we've been talking a lot about the last few episodes and how, like, the inertia you want a show to feel like it's having towards the end of its run. And the impulse for that inertia to be plot-based, you know, because, like, the thing's going to happen and we got to find the thing and we got to whatever. But so much of these back half of the fourth season episodes are about emotional inertia. It's about, like, where these characters are, where they're heading, who they are, you know, and even peeling back new layers and cutting into the onion of who these guys are and finding
Well, if you think about
things.
It, you know, the plot... to find Earth. And that's what's so great about the mid-season finale. It's almost like, we got that out of the way.
Yeah. Right.
You know what I mean? We found it and it wasn't what we thought. And that, I think, opened up these incredible character explorations. And I agree with you that is the mark of a good show and the strengths of these of the back half of season 4. For sure.
And we've gone through so much of the despair coming out of that, right? Of they've been looking for Earth for so long and then what it turned out to be. And then sort of this desperation and then into the mutiny episodes and the lashing out at authority and everything. And then now it's in this, like the montage, all the stuff, now it's in this Groundhog Day cycle again where they've just got their everyday hats on of like, we're just going to get through this. Like what's next. Right. So it allows you to have these episodes where you really break it down, but it's moving the story forward, but you don't really know how yet.
Yeah.
But you're breaking into these characters in the final moments. I think it's done very well.
Yeah. I mean, it just allows these devastating emotional moments. And in a way, because it's not about the plot. I mean, ultimately, it is. Hera is significant. Even these notes that Kara is discovering, and obviously Kara isn't significant. I mean, these are all things that pay off plot-wise, but that's not why we love these characters. It's not why we love the show. It's that emotional connection. And it's so incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have a frack down, Ms. Helfer?
I sort of
Are you familiar
already...
with the frack downs, Bear?
No.
A frack down is less the suffix of that word down implies some level of judgment. It is the most noteworthy thing for you in watching this episode. It can be a good thing. It can be a bad thing. It very often is a good thing. It overwhelmingly is a good thing. But, you know, for me, it's a thing that I've seen by watching it. For you guys, it could be a thing either behind the scenes or the experience of making it. Whatever strikes your fancy would be your freck down of the week. So, Tricia.
I sort of already mentioned one that was just gut-wrenching for me. The hug moment between Hilo and Athena.
Mm-hmm.
I had so many moments in this that I kind of sort of broke down a little bit. I broke down a couple of times. yeah. Although I rewatched Deadlock right before this and because I was a little high on propofol when we did I'd had minor surgery that morning, so I was like, I just want to set my mind straight again leading into this. But and I cried when Six lost her baby. But anyway,
yeah.
The other, I think, that's really sticky. There's so many moments, but either when Kara's playing and she's starting to play and she's like crying and she doesn't want to, that moment, or when the four, not Anders, obviously, because he's not with them, but the four recognize the music. I didn't know that you were playing,
yeah.
But that moment of them recognizing the music, and it just sort of, to me, like it's all coming full circle.
Mine's very similar because I mean, there's so many moments, there's so many shots, there's so many parts of my personality that are all over this episode. But the moment that just, for me, that experience comes full circle when, I think it's shortly before the Cylons get up from the table and walk over, there's this overhead shot where you've got the four hands on the piano and everything comes together. And you guys, I just drop the beat so hard. Like, it's so badass. And I remember because I'm building up to, like, when I'm scoring that sequence, I go, when do I just give it to you? When do we get to have it? And it's that shot. And it's like the drums kick in. And for me, it's like seeing that, it's so cathartic because it's not just like, oh, I worked on that episode for a week. It's like I worked on this for a year. And it all built up to the reveal, and that shot sort of is my favorite moment of the reveal, and it has all this emotional buildup before and all this emotional resonance afterward. But I remember when I first watched the rough cut, I was like, oh, that's my shot. That's the one. I know, like, that's...
You Babe Ruthed it?
Drop the beat. Yeah, I'm like, that's the one, dude. And we were talking about something else, and yeah, I don't know, I didn't want to call it when it got there, but I want to be like, that's when I dropped the beat, you guys. I don't know. There's so many things. It's impossible. Because really, you know what it is? In terms of the frackdown, this episode is the frackdown for the show for me.
Mm.
That's why when you guys talked to me about this, I was like, there's only one episode that I want to talk about. I could talk about them all. But the one that condenses my entire experience and then like one-ups it is this one. So it's almost like I can't even pick a thing inside this, because this whole thing is like so unique for me that it you know, it changed my life.
Well,
Mark, and how are you gonna follow that?
Seriously, like,
sorry, bro.
I feel like I feel like the Rolling Stones trying to follow James Brown. Like, oh, he went out and
but
did
seriously
that.
For somebody that just watched the show, I mean, like, I don't actually know that the episode, I think it's a good episode, but it's like, it's great to always talk to people that didn't put in everything that me and Tricia did. Does this episode stand out to you emotionally, or does it feel like, who's this piano guy?
No, it's funny. And Tricia and I have talked about it. I've seen the first two seasons so much. Like, there's a lot of times when I'd rewatch it and I'd go like, I just want to watch that one again. I want to watch 33 again. Oh, I want to see the drop and pop from Exodus again.
Yeah.
Rarely do I get as far into four in a rewatch like that. And so a lot of this has been watching it fresh again and like kind of forgetting some things that had happened and like, ooh, that's cool. Ooh,
yeah.
Is Boomer really going to screw him over? Ooh, I don't know. But I think that I'm also a little bit kinder to the show in this rewatch that I'm doing, because I'm not writing about it every night and I'm not in the middle of it like as I was the first time around. And so, yeah, like this episode, I hadn't appreciated, and especially now that I'm involved in making television, I hadn't appreciated just how many things this show is doing right in its final run.
Yeah.
You know, because it's so hard to land a bird this big and to have all of the components firing on all of the cylinders and having everything kind of find its place and its rhythm. It's really kind of astonishing. And so for me, yeah, like it this episode Deadlock, like a lot of them I had forgotten before, but are total standouts in this, you know, mega go round that Trisha and I have sentenced ourselves to.
It feels like it's instead of like a knock you over the head final, you know, final half of the season, knowing we're gonna finish, it feels like very subtle. It's like ramping you up for a finale as opposed to like, here, there's gonna be this and this and this and this and this. It's more like, here's a subtlety, here's a little thing, and now this is gonna tie in here, and this is gonna tie in here, and it's all wrapping it up, but subtly.
Like the older I get, the more I realize that the thing you want out of a television show is not bombast. I mean, at least not in the end, because it's about the characters. And it's all about the characters. That's why you form these sometimes years long relationships with them. It's not because, oh, lasers and time travel and what? Angels. It's what's happening to these people.
And I think also, you know, being in the moment at back then, maybe the show was so good in one regard that it hurt itself, that the idea of like, who's the final five? What's the plan? That it's like all this shit that you look at it now and it's like, that's not what mattered and it's not why we liked the show.
Yeah.
But we got so obsessed with it. The plot became this thing that like, I think almost became unwieldy, you know, where and what I love is that the writers knew not to succumb to that this is what we want to go out on. We want to have these character moments. We want to feel, it's not just like, ooh, they captured Hera and now what does that mean? It's like, it's all about how that makes Chief Tyrell feel, you know, like that's so effective.
It and really is.
To show to have the restraint to be able to just do that is amazing.
It's very much the, you know, sometimes you don't get what you want, but you get what you need. And this is a show that very much was about giving you what you need. And I appreciate that, you know, as a storyteller. And, you know, so my Frackdown is this, I'm not going to say it's a small scene because it's actually a pretty hefty scene, but it's that first scene with Boomer and Tyrell, you know, through the fence, the first time they project, but it's the kind of scene you can only do at the end of a show because it's all about these two characters' history. It's all about the road that they've been down, you know, who've been, you know, they can be honest with each other because of the shit they've been through together and sometimes because of each other. And to find some sense of grace at the end of that, where it's like, listen, you know, I wanted to fray you. I wanted to hate you. It didn't work. You know, the most important thing is now that we both know who we are. And let's make the most out of the time we have left. You know,
and he says you can't force people to love you at the point of a gun.
Yeah.
Right, part of that, right? She's like it's
all about this relationship that's sort of, that began the show in a way and is now kind of twisted and perambulated and warped into this thing now. And the gift that gives you as a storyteller and gives you as an audience, which is I'm rewarded for this investment in these characters.
That is totally unique to the medium. You can't have that kind of connection in a shorter form.
No, I mean, and you can't even have that connection in a novel really, because you're ingesting it too fast. Like the level of time you're giving this thing, you know, like I just finished a 10 season watch of The Walking Dead with my family.
Wow.
Like we started, we had nothing else to do. So we were able to just
perfect
like
quarantine mood.
Yes. We were able to watch two episodes a night for 4 months. And so we watched it all, but you know, that feeling of having watched it in real time of like, no, I've given this show 10 years of my life. I have a
you
feeling
and me both,
you,
buddy.
You know what that's like.
Yes, but, sir.
But the rewards, the yields that gives you, is unique in any kind of storytelling medium. And the respect I have for that is so immense that when it's done this well, when it pays back the audience for that time investment, it's miraculous. So yeah, that's my frack down.
Aww.
Awesome.
Yay. So I guess we should all just go home now, huh?
I guess we should all just go home now. You know.
What 90 million things are you working on now, Bear? It's always difficult for me to keep up in any given day.
I was working on a lot of television that as of this taping is not in production right now. Of course, speaking of Ron Moore, I'm working on Outlander, going into our sixth season. Walking Dead, still going strong. And I've been doing more features. You know, I've been pushing into that space.
What's the cartoon that you just posted about the other day that I watched that on Instagram about five times in a row? Because I realized it just made me happy.
Oh my gosh.
I just was smiling watching it.
I did a Netflix film called Animal Crackers, which is my first ever animated film for kids. Like, it's just a fun kind of, you know, like, it's an indie film, but it's like kind of like, it's just geared toward kids. It's bright and vibrant and fun and crazy and like the opposite tone of Battlestar Galactica in every way possible. Like, I keep joking with the director. I was like, why did you hire me to do this? Like, that was great. That was really fun. And I love that it actually had been tied up in a lot of legal madness. I scored it several years ago. It was finished in 2017. And it's only now coming out. And of course, at the time, we're like, oh no, we want it to come out theatrically. And now it's landed on Netflix at the height of a pandemic. Everybody's at home and they've already watched everything else. It's been in the top 5 or 10 on Netflix for like 2 weeks.
That's
it's crazy.
Amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah, super fun. So I'm doing other stuff I can't talk about yet, but there's some, you know, there's some fun stuff coming up, but I'm definitely looking forward to being able to go back into production. I mean, I'm doing some animated stuff. I'm doing video games. But it's hard, you know, when you're, you know, Walking Dead or Outlander. I mean, like, that's a big set, you know, and we can't shoot it right now, you know? I mean, and Walking Dead, like in Georgia, dude, oh my God. Like, you know what I mean? So I don't know when that's coming back, you know? I mean, but yeah, I'm keeping busy. I'm happy, and I'm really finding opportunities to do unusual things and experiment and collaborate with people and do things like Animal Crackers, do things that I haven't done before. And I'm just so grateful that Battlestar is what created those opportunities for me, because it was weird. It was unusual. So it sort of let people understand that, you know, I could do things that, you know, maybe push the envelope a little or that were experimental and were weird. So that's been, you know, that's been great. To say it opened doors is the understatement of the, you know, the century.
That's awesome. So happy for you, Bear.
Thanks, you guys. And thanks for doing this podcast. I was so excited about it when you first told me about it. And I'm thrilled that it's finally worked out for us to do it.
Indeed. And as always, there's a whole mess of people we need to thank. And the first person we always do
is you,
Bear McCreary.
Oh my gosh. Well, you're very welcome.
For gifting us with his awesome theme song.
We got to thank him once before in person at the live reading of 33.
We did.
Oh, that was so fun. That was so delightful.
It was the best pre-quarantine thing I think I did.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. That was amazing.
Yeah. So thank you again. Thank you again for your theme song. Thank you again for spending your evening with us.
Yes. And thank you to Sci-Fi Wire.
Indeed, for whom we forgot to take an ad break because we were too in it.
Brett will find a place somewhere.
Yes. We always. Sorry. I guess you didn't get to sell your
just
penis
run
pills.
The first ad after 2.5 hours. It's
fine. Yeah, who's going to notice? And yes, thank you to Brett Boehm for making us sound relatively legible. Or audible, or I don't know, words anymore. It's late, you guys. I'm fresh out of words.
We'll just put a theme there instead.
Indeed. Yeah. But we will be back next week. And what are we going to talk about, Trisha?
We're going to talk about, I'm looking up, Daybreak. No, Daybreak. No, we're not.
Islanded in a Stream of Stars.
Directed by Eddie Olmos.
Ooh, hey. I wonder if we can get him to stop by.
Ooh, I don't know. Maybe.
Stay tuned, true believers. but yes, thank you everybody for continuing to listen, for continuing to make this little kid's dream come true.
Yay. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Trisha.
For being the little kid with big dreams. Yay. I'm assuming that's what it was. I don't know. It could be. We're all little kids with big dreams.
We all are. Otherwise, we wouldn't be in Hollywood.
Exactly.
But yes, take care, everybody. Hopefully, we are not still in the middle of this. But if we are, wear a mask, wash your hands. We love you.
20 seconds.
So say we all.
So say we all.